Hello and welcome to this podcast from Blackwell Online. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is the translator and biographer Rosamund Bartlett. Rosamund has written extensively on Russian cultural history, especially its music and literature. As well as her book on Wagner and Russia, a co-authored literary guide to Russia, and an edited volume on Shostakovich in context, she's also the author of an acclaimed biography of Chekhov, and a distinguished translator of his short stories and letters. She's currently working on a cultural history of opera in Russia, and her new translation of Anna Karenina is forthcoming from Oxford Wells Classics. When we met up recently, it was to discuss her acclaimed biography of Tolstoy. The book, which is out now in paperback, is covered in glowing reviews. To my way of thinking, perhaps none captures what makes the book special better than this one from the Catholic Herald. The reviewer writes, "Despite the enormous scholarship needed to embark on such a life, Bartlett never loses sight of her subject in all his fascinating facets. Her book is a worthy testimony to a great, flawed man." When we met, I began by asking Rosamund what had convinced her that the time was right for a new life of Tolstoy.
Well, the last major biography of Tolstoy in English was written by A.N. Wilson, and it came out in 1988, and it's a very dependable biography. It's deservedly one that's very, very widely respected. But it was written at a time before the huge impact of Glasnost on publishing and on scholarship in Russia. And an awful lot has been published since then. And just the very fact that the Soviet Union no longer exists means that everything has changed in the way we write about authors in Russia these days. And I felt it was time to reassess his legacy, and also to try and make sense of his very important role in the Russian cultural imagination, not only during his lifetime, but since then. And so I've carried the story on after Tolstoy's death up until the present day, because we in the West have a fairly fixed view, I think, of who Tolstoy is, and he's primarily the author of War and Peace and Anna Karenina. But there's this whole other side to his legacy, which is to do with his religious searchings, and that took him the last 30 years of his life to develop. It was a part of his life that he really cherished more than the 25 years in which he was a professional writer of fiction. I think there is a tendency to be rather superficial in our assessment of Tolstoy. You know, we tend to think of him, well, you know, he was a great writer for an initial period, and then he basically turned his back on writing fiction and became a rather cranky preacher. But actually, I think he was someone whose ideas had huge resonance, actually, not only in Russia, but outside Russia, internationally. And I wanted to put him in the context of his times, and also really explore how and why the Russians have a very tricky relationship with him today.
Do you remember how you began this project? Did you sit down and read his works, or read his diaries, or look at previous biographies? Or how did you actually approach it? Because it's quite a sizable undertaking, isn't it? To the long life of such a huge cultural icon who left so many words of his own, and who has been written about so much by so many other people in the years since he died.
I approached the task with humility and a huge degree of fear, actually. I think anyone in front of a big project is really seized by fear above all else. For me, though, it wasn't so much thinking about the actual stuff of the life. There's huge life. I mean, that's terrifying enough. But it was really my approach to conveying Tolstoy's life. And I didn't want to write another biography, because there's been so much written about Tolstoy. I didn't want to write another biography which just sort of began with his birth and then went through to his death. I wanted to give it more shape than that. And when I was writing about Chekhov, I was also translating his short stories, and found huge amount of inspiration in the process of, you know, intimately working with Chekhov's creative processes. And it shaped the way I wrote my life of Chekhov, and it shaped the way I conceptualized his life. For me, Chekhov's a quite a quirky writer, so my biography of Chekhov's quite quirky. Tolstoy is not a quirky writer, but I'm translating Anna Karenina, and I mean, I'm very lucky to have the opportunity to do that. And I'm in the middle of that project at the moment. And so a lot of my inspiration for thinking about how to conceive of conveying Tolstoy's life came from that experience. For example, Tolstoy, from the very beginning, decided to write in short chapters, and for each short chapter to convey a story. And I thought that in my own biography of Tolstoy, it would be good to sort of echo that. And some of my chapters are actually quite long. In fact, they get longer and longer and longer because his life got bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's actually quite deliberate. However, I wanted to tell a story in each of the chapters. And I spent a long time just thinking about Tolstoy's life through reading all the sources that are available. And that's many, many shelves in the library. There are lots and lots of Russian sources and quite a lot written by Western scholars. I've also, of course, been thinking about the processes of Russian cultural history for a long time. And what started emerging in my mind was this idea that Tolstoy had actually more than one life, that he had many lives, and that most of these lives were actually deeply Russian lives. That is really the concept that I decided to follow. As the longer I went through with this idea, the more confident I became with it. So each chapter is the story of one or more lives in this great life. And I understand that not only as the sort of typical stages of a life, childhood, adolescence, adulthood, old age. And I don't understand that merely in terms also of social class, because, you know, he was someone who was born into the aristocracy, and the concept of Russian nobility is something that's different. But I also have explored various sort of Russian archetypes that Tolstoy embodies. And it seems to me that he was somehow someone who absorbed the whole of the Russian experience in a way, and it sort of came out in his life. It was expressed at different stages, and, you know, he was on this permanent quest for the truth, and that led him to going through the stages of, you know, going from being a desperate gambler in that Russian tradition to becoming a repentant nobleman, and then to becoming a pilgrim when he became very devout, and then becoming a nihilist when he decided to reject it all. And the one thing that's very consistent all the way through, and this sort of constantly evolving life, is the sort of measure to which Tolstoy pursued all these lives, because he was someone who didn't do anything in half measures. He was extreme. And that's also a you know, quite a Russian trait. And yes, it's a little bit of a cliche, but nevertheless, you know, when Tolstoy was a gambler, he did that to the point that he actually had to gamble away the house in which he was born, and which he deeply loved. So it was dismantled brick by brick and bought by a neighbouring landowner and rebuilt again down the road. And when he decided to become a peasant school teacher, he did that too with incredible commitment. And when he became a writer, you know, he wanted to write a novel, but it wasn't just going to be any old European novel. It was going to be sort of the ultimate novel. And it's true, not only of Tolstoy, but of most of those great 19th century writers, that their novels cannot be really put into the canon of the European novel. They're sort of, they don't fit. And the Russians do this in a number of different spheres, that they take on these sort of Western ideas. They have a huge impact. But in the process of absorbing them, the Russians sort of add their own creative genius and turn them into something else. And it's not just a question of just imitating the West. There's something different going on. So War and Peace, you know, you can't really classify it as a sort of traditional European novel in any normal sense. And Tolstoy was proud of that. He was proud of the fact that no Russian novel could really fit into that kind of confine. Tolstoy's brother, Nikolai, once reflected that, you know, everything that Tolstoy did, he just sort of pursued to the ultimate, even if it was, you know, physical exercise. And he got, you know, very wrapped up in beekeeping once, and for a while that was his all-consuming passion. Then he turned to learning ancient Greek. He just went from one thing to the other.
He kept drawing up programs for himself, didn't he? Especially early on, you know, he would draw up lists of things he had to do, languages he had to learn, skills he had to master. You know, he decides to learn music, so he imports a piano teacher and does his scales every day. And he obviously, as you say, never did things by halves.
I suppose, he just set himself these ridiculous standards, which he could never really live up to. And thank heavens, actually, he didn't live up to them, because later in life, when he decided to sort of completely redesign his life on Christian principles, there were a lot of people who said, well, why are you continuing to live in your ancestral home? If you really mean to live as Christ instructed, you should be living in a little hut. And of course, there are many, many contradictions. And yet, we have to admire him for at least trying to put those principles into practice. You would have thought he would have been perhaps an insufferable person and incredibly sanctimonious, but the evidence is that he was someone totally compelling and charismatic. And most people who went to visit him in Jasna Polyana, and there were thousands of people who made a pilgrimage to Jasna Polyana to go and see him and consult him on problems, there were some people who were really quite sceptical, but they came away thinking, well, actually, no, I was really impressed by his sincerity. He really does mean it. And as much as we might think of him as rather eccentric and cranky, he had some very real criticisms to make of the Russian establishment, and the kind of criticisms which are rather uncomfortable questions for the Russian government today, in fact.
You mentioned a moment ago his noble birth, and I thought it might be interesting just to go back to 1828 and get you to say a little bit about the milieu into which he was born, because it's got its own particularity, hasn't it? It's quite different from perhaps Western nobility, if that's what we think of as a comparison.
Yeah, the Russian nobility was not like the Western aristocracy. It was a social class, so it was sort of enshrined in law, in as far as we had laws in Imperial Russia. And it had been created by Peter the Great in the 18th century, and he wanted every subject of the Russian Empire to serve him, the autocrat, and he created this service state. And so the nobility were given privileges. They were given land, and they were given promotion in the army if they deserved it, and they were given human beings in the form of serfs, of course. And in return for those privileges, they were required to serve for life. And over the course of the 18th century, successive rulers whittled down that period of service to the point where Peter III, who was the hapless husband of Catherine the Great, actually abolished service for the nobility altogether, which meant that they were left with all these lands and sometimes hundreds of serfs, and were able to live quite well. And that is the sort of fundamental reason we had a revolution in 1917, of course, because when the period of service for the nobility was abolished, the peasants stayed in the same position. They didn't get their freedom back. They were still slaves. And the nobility was a class which embraced both the very high aristocracy, who may have been princes or princesses, and people who often had very little at all. So it's a slightly unfamiliar concept to a sort of Western mind. And you have to also remember that the titles that Russians inherited were inherited by all the children, not just by the firstborn. So there were many more princes and princesses and many more counts. And in fact, Tolstoy was born Graf Tolstoy. He was born Count Tolstoy. And that was a noble rank that was created by Peter the Great in the 18th century. And it was based on German aristocratic titles. So he was Count Tolstoy, and his three brothers were Count Tolstoy, and his sister was Countess. And he then had 13 children, and they also became counts and countesses. So there, for that reason, it's different as well. And yet he did have a very distinguished lineage. And grew up in this sort of paradise of this Russian country estate with people waiting on him. And he grew up speaking flawless French, which was the lingua franca for the aristocracy at that time, and never had to really venture outside the grounds, which was a sort of wonderful playground for a little boy with lakes and rivers and horses and hunting dogs. So it was a way of life in 1828, when he was born, that was really at its apex then, but already on its way out, actually, because it was a sort of bankrupt way of life that couldn't continue. And it was one that was preserved under Nicholas I, who was a very reactionary Tsar. He'd just become Tsar in 1825. He'd become Tsar just after the Decembrist uprising, which was the first attempt of the educated Russian elite to try and introduce some kind of democracy into Russian government. And it was a dismal failure. And for the extent of Nicholas I's reign, he was determined just to preserve things as they were, to try and stop any kind of subversive thought. So departments of philosophy were shut down in universities, and the secret police was very, very active. It was a way of life, of course, which was fine if you were an aristocrat growing up in the countryside. Those things didn't really affect you. But it was an ossified way of life that really couldn't continue.
So what would have been the expectations for a young man of Tolstoy's class, of what his life would hold in terms of really how he'd spend his days, what a meaningful existence might consist of?
Well, there were very set routes for the children of the nobility. They were usually educated at home by foreign tutors. And for the males, it was usually a case of either going into the civil service in St. Petersburg or going into the army. The Tolstoy brothers actually were quite eccentric, and they didn't exactly follow that route. But Tolstoy, of course, had a fairly sort of dissolute few years when he came into his inheritance. I mean, that was also a very traditional route for the nobility, because a lot of them had, you know, these ill-gotten gains. They didn't inherit money that they'd worked for. It was just money that came in because of the work that the peasants did on their land. So a lot of them just sort of frittered it away on gypsy singers and on gambling. And Tolstoy did that for a few years, and then set off with his brother, just on a whim almost, to the Caucasus, where his brother was serving. And his eldest brother, Nikolai, who by all counts was a very likeable person, didn't seem to have very much ambition. He sort of served with modest success in the army, and at some point in the 1850s retired, but then obviously didn't know what to do with himself and re-enlisted and went back to the Caucasus. And he seems to have been a bit of an alcoholic, so that, you know, there were quite a few Russian nobles who had drink problems. And I think Tolstoy's other brother Sergei, who was also older than him, he basically just retired to his country estate. And what was unusual about him was that he took up with a very talented gypsy singer in Tula, which is the city near where they were lived. And because, of course, you know, he had this land and this income from the estate, he didn't necessarily have to get a job. And the same was true of Tolstoy, except that he soon developed this sort of burning ambition to sort of make something of his life, and started writing and started keeping this diary, which was really the sort of engine room for all of his great fictional works.
I thought it was really telling that he begins that diary in the waiting room of the venereal disease clinic at the university in Kazan.
He wrote quite sort of openly about his fall from grace at the age of 14 and felt ashamed by it. You know, his brothers had taken him to a brothel, so he contracted gonorrhea and ended up in the university clinic. And that was really when he started pulling himself together, because he decided he didn't want to have any servants around him then, and he started writing this diary. And that is really when the whole of his sort of fictional career begins. And this diary he would keep on and off for the rest of his life, and at certain times it became a very, very important outlet for his feelings. And it's where, of course, he started setting himself these impossible ideals to follow.
We perhaps think today of the Russian novelists as some great pantheon. And yet, being a Russian novelist wasn't really a job description in Tolstoy's time, was it?
No, except that the Russian nobles often had a lot of time on their hands, and they were living on these country estates in the middle of nowhere. And there was in the 19th century as well, in the middle of the 19th century, this very urgent inquiry into what was Russia, what was Russian, and where was Russia going. And so all the great writers, and indeed all the artists and musicians in the late 19th century, were engaged on this quest to explore what Russianness was. And that came on the back, of course, of this enforced westernization. And Nicholas I, who was Tsar when Tolstoy was born, was someone for whom the state was preeminent, the army was preeminent. And he promoted a kind of culture that was very Western in origin. I mean, he was most of all interested in German culture. And if you look at the paintings that come out of the Imperial Academy in the time of Nicholas I, you know, they're all inspired by classical themes. So there was a huge desire amongst the Russian creative elite in the middle of the 19th century to sort of react against that, to actually work with Russian material.
And another difference between writing a novel in Russia then and now is that censorship and political oversight was clearly a force to be reckoned with.
Yes, and I think the other thing to note is that censorship, in a way, was a kind of stimulus to creativity back then. It wasn't so bad as in the Soviet period. Tolstoy, of course, also encountered the censor. But the intelligentsia, who was this class of Russian society that was most deeply engaged with introducing a degree of integrity into Russian political life, was the class that really fated the writer as a kind of second government. And that was something that continued during the Soviet period. But the first professional critics in Russia, Bielinsky, for example, would very openly champion writers as the sort of great hope for Russia. They were the only people who were able to speak the truth. And so that was very important.
You mentioned, Rosamund, that Tolstoy doesn't have one life. He has really multiple lives, and his career and his life go through different phases. Did you find particular phases more difficult to bring into focus as you travelled through this life? Were there any areas that you really found difficult to understand what was impelling him forward?
Actually, I found the lives easier to grapple with the longer I got into his life. It was the early chapters I found most difficult, and that's because there just simply aren't enough sources to be able to build up a very vivid portrait of Tolstoy's life. And so the sources are thin on the ground, and one is relying on a lot of testimony from Tolstoy himself, which is a wonderful source in one sense, but you know, you want some sort of objective views. And he participated in the sort of mythology of his own life, and you know, wrote his memoirs towards the end of his life. And there's a particular slant, of course. And so I found that difficult. And you're also rather circumscribed by the way in which all the previous biographical materials have presented the lives. But later on, when he starts writing more and his life is documented more, actually it gets a lot easier, because that's just a question of really deciding which sources to use and which ones to leave out.
As a female biographer, were there particular areas of Tolstoy's relationship with women that you felt had been neglected or misreported that you wanted to zoom in particular?
Well, one of the things which makes it a good time for writing about Tolstoy now is the sea change in attitudes towards his wife, for example, Sofia Andreevna, who had a pretty tough time being married to Lev Nikolaevich. not only have attitudes changed, but there have been more materials that have come out. Her diary came out in 1978. And I have to say, unfortunately, it's still an edition which is full of censorship. And there aren't even any ways of seeing what's been censored from it. But over the last few years, there have been extracts from her autobiography published. And now it seems that that's going to be produced in full in Russian. There's an English translation which has just come out. And the diaries she wrote have been translated into English, of course, and have been quite popular. But she wrote very self-consciously because the Tolstoys shared their diaries. And I particularly wanted to draw from the letters she wrote to her sister Tanya when she wasn't really thinking that these were going to be published after her death. I think she's much more frank and open. There are quite a few more letters to draw from. And I suppose just because I am female myself, I think probably I must write in a different way from the male biographers of Tolstoy. I don't think one should make too much of the gender of the biographer, but certainly in Tolstoy scholarship, she's had a bit of a bad press, Sofia Andreevna. Indeed, you know, there's been such a change in attitudes to her that in June of this year, the first biography in Russian appeared of her, and there was a collection of articles that focused on her role and contribution. That would have been unprecedented. There's also, I think, a biography now in English about her. So there have been books about their marriage, but this is the first biography of her. So she was a very talented woman. And the sort of misogyny that you find in Soviet scholarship has obscured the fact that, you know, she really contributed in a very substantial way to Tolstoy's success as a writer, you know, not only copying out his manuscripts, but just being a sort of constant source of domestic stability for him. And
a physical presence. You describe her lying curled up on a rug at his feet, which he insisted on she did while he was writing War and Peace, I think.
Yes, I mean, at the very beginning of their marriage, he actually wanted her to be part of the creative process. And he'd deliberately married the middle sister in a family where there were three daughters because he wanted to be able to mould his future wife. And Sonia was a lot younger than him. He was 34 when they got married and she was 18. 18 in 1862 was a lot younger than it would be today. She, you know, really hadn't seen very much of life. And she very willingly set off to Yasna Polyana with Tolstoy, having grown up in Moscow, in the Kremlin, where her father was a doctor for the court. He wanted her to be part of his creative life. And when they set off on this journey to create War and Peace, she was there physically, as you say, in the room, in his study. And he'd gone out bear shooting one day and shot this bear. And the rug was on the floor. And yes, she used to he used to want her to be sitting there at his feet while he wrote.
And if you were asked to say more generally what Tolstoy's attitude to women was, what would you say, and how did you respond to it as a biographer?
Well, there are a lot of feminist scholars who have made a quite convincing case for Tolstoy being a feminist. The evidence for that is chapters, for example, in Anna Karenina, where Tolstoy goes into really quite a lot of detail about childbirth, for example. So male writers didn't do that kind of thing by and large. However, you have to balance that with Tolstoy's contempt for women as a gender, which I think is stronger, actually. He, on numerous occasions, you know, makes very derogatory comments about women as essentially as, you know, inferior to men along the way. I mean, he had very few women friends whom he regarded as his intellectual equals. I mean, there was an exception for Alexandra Andreevna Tolstaya, who was a distant relative, who was a lady-in-waiting at court. And she was a very smart woman. She didn't get married, and she was very attractive. She was older than Tolstoy, and he was actually quite attracted to her initially, but didn't see her as marriage material. But she's about the only woman he actually had time for as a sort of thinking person. And you get the sense that actually he's rather fearful of female intelligence, and the evidence for that, I think, probably is also Anna Karenina, where he creates this amazing character in Anna Karenina herself, someone who is in a way, and again, a sort of autobiographical projection. She's someone who sort of wants to live truthfully. And so she breaks out of this artificial marriage to someone where there's no love. Yet in fulfilling herself as a woman, she has to be punished by Tolstoy. He's a very sort of manipulative writer. And I found actually teaching this novel quite tiresome sometimes, because you're always coming up against this didactic urge. One of the reasons I wanted to write the biography was to sort of try and understand it better, understand him better, because I recognised this was probably my shortcoming and not his.
We talked earlier, Rosamund, about 1828, and I wanted to end by talking about 1928, because by then Tolstoy had been dead 18 years and Russia had changed radically, dramatically. The revolution had come. And Tolstoy remained, I suppose you could say, a sort of political hot potato. What were the Bolsheviks to do with him? So I thought maybe just in conclusion, because your book does go on beyond that into the 20th century, you could just say a little bit about how they tried to reconcile Tolstoy with their political system.
In 1928, there were numerous celebrations of Tolstoy's centenary. There were publications of books about Tolstoy. There were celebratory evenings in the Bolshoi Theatre. There were libraries named after Tolstoy. There were streets beginning to be named after Tolstoy. And there was a whole great sort of industry that was initiated around that time. And it was really at this point that the official attitude to Tolstoy on the part of the Communist Party crystallised. And that meant basically expunging everything to do with Tolstoy's spiritual legacy and remembering him only as a sort of critic of Tsarist Russia and as a great prose writer, and someone, of course, who championed the Russian people in all of his writing. But you have to remember that even in the 1920s, the Tolstoyans, including Tolstoy's own daughter, found it increasingly difficult to honour Tolstoy. And Alexandra, who was given the job of running Yasna Polyana after 1917, was actually arrested several times by the secret police and found herself the victim of a kind of hate campaign on the part of the apparatchiks down in Tula. And eventually she decided that she could no longer remain in Russia. And in 1929, she was invited to lecture in Japan, and she managed to get an exit visa, and she never returned to the Soviet Union and became a sort of enemy of the people, a complete persona non grata. She lived a very long life. She died in 1979 and was too ill, unfortunately, to be able to accept the invitation to come back to Russia in 1978, which was another big anniversary, the 150th anniversary of Tolstoy's birth. So there's a whole story to be told about the fate of all the friends and disciples of Tolstoy in the Soviet period, and particularly the Tolstoyans who resolutely stuck to living according to Tolstoy's dictates and were forced to emigrate, in a way, internal emigration, that is, to Siberia, and found that they were told to collectivize, even though they were leading in an exemplary sort of communist lifestyle with no private property and working the land.
Rosamund Bartlett. Tolstoy, A Russian Life is published by Profile and is out now in paperback. A.N. Wilson, himself a past biographer of Tolstoy, has said of it that it conveys Tolstoy to me more vividly than any biography I have read. You can find out more about the book and Rosamund's others, as well as several million more, by visiting blackwell.co.uk. You'll also find a podcast archive there with over 150 author interviews by clicking on the podcast tab on the homepage. That's all for this edition of the Blackwell Online podcast, but I hope you'll join me again soon for another programme. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.